From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Since the time of the ancients, we have traveled. It's had its discomforts and dangers, but mostly we've valued what we learn from other peoples, the big wide world, and about ourselves. In this modern era, we've figured out how to do it on a grand industrial scale. The lonely traveler is a rarity. We board cruise ships and wide-bodied jets and travel by the millions, even billions, to shop and stare and clap and dance and swim and more. It's great and it's awful. This hour on Point, the exploding business of travel and tourism. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Do you know how big the global tourism industry has grown? Is this too much of a good thing? Do you feel trapped and herded wherever you go? Do you still know how to go far from the madding crowd? Or do you prefer the crowds to the lonely highway? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Elizabeth Becker, Pulitzer Prize-winning former correspondent for The New York Times, former senior foreign editor at National Public Radio, author of books on the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia and Americans in Vietnam, obviously herself a road warrior and world traveler. Her new book is called Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. Elizabeth Becker, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
We think of travel in such personal, intimate terms. You remind us it is a gigantic industry.
And you hit it right on the nail of the... it is very intimate to us. In the olden days, we'd invite friends over to look at our slides of our latest trip. Now it is growing daily. As you said, it's 1 billion tourists a year last year, the first year. And the actual economic size is even more astonishing, $6.4 trillion into the global economy. And it's the biggest employer, one out of 11 people. It's astonishing.
But give us some, you say this is right up there with oil, with finance, with agriculture. You're talking as big as it gets in terms of an industry.
Yes, and it's been hiding in plain sight all this while. Just for example, this morning, I can't help but see tourism everywhere. The North Koreans who sentenced that fellow to 15 years of hard labor.
The American, yes.
Yeah, tour operator.
He was a tour operator, so wherever you go.
I can't help but see it now. There's a couple things that happened that explain this in sort of a classic historical way. One was the end of the Cold War when the borders melted. That literally opened up half of the world to all of us. And then secondly, this technological revolution that you alluded to with the wide-bodied planes and the internet, all kinds of improvements. So it's very easy to go halfway across the globe now.
We take it almost for granted, but you early in the book, you take us back, and maybe you'd walk us through his story, because it's so instructive here. Is it Arthur Frommer, who first wrote the book that a certain generation, you know, clutched to its chest as it went abroad, Europe on $5 a day. Back when this was a big deal for regular people, I mean, it's still a big deal. Look, as we sit here right now, you've got a lot of people in this country without jobs. The last thing on their mind is going abroad. But just look at the numbers. 1 billion people traveling abroad one way or another last year. It's happening all over the place. Take us back to Arthur Frommer's story, how he got started into the whole realm of travel, and what it meant, what it said about Americans, for one, sort of newbie quality when it came to foreign travel, what, half a century ago?
That was one of my favorite interviews. Thank you for bringing it up. Arthur Frommer was in military intelligence in post-war Germany.
Post-World War II, so we're going way back.
The 50s.
So many wars, yeah.
So many wars, so many people. And he noticed that there were military flights all over the continent. He was a very clever man. He was already a lawyer. And he figured out through the timetables how he could catch a free flight here, a free flight there, and do sorts of things he never thought would be possible. You know, great Italian meal in Venice, seeing the Eiffel Tower in Paris.
And affordable on his military man's, not a lot of money, sort of allotment.
Yes, it was free travel, essentially. So the other guys in the barracks said, how in the world are you doing this, Arthur? So he printed mimeograph, the olden days, you know, how to see Europe while you're a GI. And it was, you know, sold out within a day. He he finishes up his service.
Just to his fellow folks in the military community there.
Yeah, just in Germany.
Post-war Europe, yeah.
And he realized he was onto something. So when he goes back to the United States and is a lawyer, he used his vacation time to do a similar sort of thing for civilians, as he put it. And he self-produced, self-published the very first Europe on $5 a Day. Once again, it was scooped up within 24 hours, and that was it. He's never looked back.
Now, you described this as opening up, though, a whole new kind of travel. You had had the sort of grand tour of the rich, where they would go get on the cruise liner or maybe a plane later, but go for months to Europe. And instead, Frommer was feeding a different appetite and a different population of travelers.
Mm-hmm. And people who were not going to read a whole book about France, people who were going to take advantage of some real good deals. And later on in the book, I point out that one of the reasons they could afford it is because the U.S. Marshall Plan, that's the economic recovery plan for Europe after the end of World War II, included improving the French tourism sector. So a lot of those trips to Paris in those days were subsidized by the U.S. taxpayer as part of the recovery of France after World War II. It's astonishing. And I must say that when you were just mentioning that people probably during the recession weren't thinking much about vacations, in fact, they were. It was the one sector that really rebounded right away was the travel and tourism sector. It's astonishing. It's very hard to take it out of your budget.
Fair enough. But you know there are plenty of Americans with no job whatsoever who are not thinking about going to Europe this summer. And yet, I mean, they may be thinking about it, but it's just nowhere on their screen of affordables. But meanwhile, the numbers just keep growing, and it's not just Americans traveling anymore. We have new populations coming into this global stream.
With Chinese in particular, I spend two chapters on China because I was astonished at what a giant it is. And within a few years, the Chinese will be the largest number of tourists, period. And all over the world, they're preparing for them. They are different kind. There are studies about which kind of tourists you are. Americans now tend to be more cultural than they used to be. The Chinese tend to be shoppers.
So the point you're making here is that the volume of travelers has become so great. It's almost like a big river. It cuts through a lot. It cuts a wide swath. It can change even the landscape of its destinations. You've got different countries handling that more or less well. But what about the overall impact of global travel and tourism? There was a time when we were all told, get out and see the world. This is the secret to world peace and harmony. We'll go out, travel, get to know one another.
It's the quantity has really changed the quality. And as you said, if a destination or a country understands this, they'll try to control it a bit. But it's getting to be scary in lots of parts of the world. I highlight Venice, one of the most beautiful places ever. And it's now a city with a reduced population of under 60,000. And it receives every year 24 million visitors. Now, this has meant that the quality of life has really changed and deteriorated for the locals. They can no longer afford to live in their apartments. They're losing their local groceries and butcher shops and bakeries because rents are so high to catch the money from the tourists. And all those tourists are helping sort of international organizations, companies, much more than the locals. So in Venice, it's at a real crisis point. The UN recently put out a warning that forget about worrying about the water rising in Venice. Their watery grave will be through tourism.
You know, as I read and as I listen, I have such ambivalence about this because on the one hand, I understand, I can hear just what you mean, this kind of tsunami of tourists come in, they trump over everything, and there can be all kinds of effects. We'll look at them. On the other hand, you know, I've come up as a middle-class kind of guy, and it was just deliriously exciting to think of seeing the world. I mean, you know, who's to be denied that experience in the age we live in? That's part of the thrill of life.
I agree. I love to travel. But, you know, I hate to sound like a mother, but with every right, there's a responsibility. And this is one of the things I'm trying to get across in this book. I want us to continue to support really great travel, but we should be cleaning up after ourselves, so to speak. And a lot of the industry has looked at the bottom line rather than preserving the destination. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book. It is enormous. And some places will just disappear.
So are you saying it's our responsibility as individual travelers to clean up after ourselves, or what, to somehow regulate the travel industry, which has become so large, or just for countries to themselves put down the right guidelines to keep it clean?
Well, it's like a lot of issues. It's yes for all of the above. As a traveler, a tourist, it's very good to do your homework and figure out what's the least offensive way you're going to be traveling. It doesn't cost any more money. It just is usually a lot more preparation. As a citizen, you know, when you welcome visitors, make sure that you understand how your government is working and is it helping you as well as the tourist.
Roseanne Cash behind us right there with Land of Dreams, theme song of Discover America, set up by the federal government here to promote tourism to the United States. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This hour about the giant business of global travel and how global tourism is changing the world. Elizabeth Becker is with us. Her new book is Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Of course, it can feel absolutely wonderful to get out into the world. The Lonely Planet is one popular guide these days. Here's the Lonely Planet video. Takes us on a tour of Beijing's lively nightlife.
I'm down in the Hutong area, and a lot of people here are just sort of hanging out on the sidewalk. It's obviously a very sultry evening here in Beijing, and there's lots of restaurants and tiny little bars that are just holes in the wall. This place is pretty slick. Check this out. We got fish in the ceiling.
In American Beijing, it's pretty slick. Fish in the ceiling, but it's not just a one-way traffic. Here are Chinese visitors reflecting on their first trip to Los Angeles. The state-run Chinese CCTV is translated here.
The scenery here is very beautiful. The people here are very warm-hearted. We had great experiences here.
Chinese tourists in the United States. Elizabeth Becker, stand by. I want to get our listeners right in here. Joe in Buffalo, New York. Thanks for calling, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I was astonished to learn that tourism was part of the Marshall Plan, and it just makes so much sense. I'd love to know if there's any chance that we could get back into that, either as like a stimulus or in place of the military aid that we give them. It seems like it would be a lot more useful than another bomb, but then I got to balance that with what you've been adding to that and the negative impact of our tourism. Is there a role that we can play in that?
Do you mean, Joe, you want a government subsidy to go to Europe to help out Europe and see the world?
Yeah, this winter would be great. It's pretty cold here in Buffalo.
Joe, I appreciate your call. Is that right, Elizabeth? Was it deliberately underwritten, American tourism in Europe?
The first flights, but most of that Marshall Aid money went to develop the tourism industry in France. And we do it now under the rubric of development aid. For countries trying to climb out of poverty, travel and tourism is often their first choice if they don't have any oil in the ground.
Yep.
And you can see from the World Bank to USAID, there are a lot of projects that very much try to make sure that countries keen on developing tourism do it in a good, clean way. So, yes, it's still going on, but we call it now development aid, not the Marshall Plan.
And it comes with a downside that Elizabeth Becker describes as well. We'll look at that. Jordan in Boulder, Colorado. Jordan, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. So I traveled through Mexico to Guatemala from Boulder by bus in 2001.
Yeah.
And, you know, those were the days, right? You could go down and all of the beach along Cancun, some down there in Oaxaca, just hadn't quite been developed to the extent that it is today.
And what do you take away from that, Jordan?
Well, now you go down there, and of course there's a million Americans, and then, you know, there's a subway and, you know, high-rise condos and all that. So I'll tell you, it disgusted me at first, but then I'll tell you what, it's a great revenue generator for Mexico, and there's all these small hidden spots there in Mexico that nobody would get to if there wasn't that portal. You know, I go down, I get a $200 round trip ticket to Cancun, take a small bus out to some cenote in the jungle, make it down to Belize, and there's none of that, you know, high traffic tourism in those areas. I still get what I want, and Mexico still makes money, and some of these smaller areas are actually getting, you know, more money because they're a little bit off the map, but they're still getting more exposure.
Jordan, it sounds like you're finding your own way, and I appreciate your call. I mean, Elizabeth, what about it here? Is there a win-win formula? Because right behind Jordan, who's going out to find his way to the little village, is that vast volume that you write about with its, yes, there's an economic upside, but maybe an environmental downside, maybe a very inequitable sharing of the economic upside. How do you look at the balance of gain and loss in our big flows, Elizabeth?
So far, I'm afraid it's looking more loss than gain. The exceptions are wonderful. I would say that sort of cruise ships are a good example. The environmental cost has gotten very big. Huge swaths of the ocean are regularly polluted. I'm not going to go into the figures, but and the incidents of accidents have gotten so much that Antarctica has now banned the larger cruise ships because they can't afford another oil spill on that very fragile landscape. And in Norway, they've had some new restrictions as well. So different countries are starting to respond to we humans trying to see everything and not necessarily knowing the danger that lurks within a cruise ship or too many people on a beach.
I mean, you heard Jordan there in Boulder say he traveled down to Guatemala from Boulder through Mexico in 2000. And, you know, those were the days. This mm-hmm. is the perpetual thing you hear on the road. If you'd only come 10 years ago, if you'd only come 20 years ago or 5 minutes ago, that's when it was great.
Yeah.
But what about the, I mean, it's not as though travel's the only thing going on. We've had huge population growth on the planet in the last several decades. Mm-hmm. We've had, you know, industrialization reaching into more and more areas. But what about the balance in terms of travel's impact on development versus degradation? Take us into some more of those scenes and what you've witnessed.
Well, for instance, I write quite a bit about Cambodia as a country that sort of got it wrong. And tourism is very important. That's the home of the magnificent Angkor temples, mm-hmm. great beaches. The government was looking more at the very quick, easy hit. And then instead of leaving the coast, the beautiful coast along the Gulf of Thailand, as it was more or less national parkland, they sold big chunks of it to foreign companies, pushed out the locals, and you now have a beach that's so degraded that the National Geographic says it's one of the 10 worst developed in the world. There's horrible amounts of sex tourism, which is a huge scourge, young children being sold to brothels for visiting tourists. And you don't have a lot of the locals are not helped by this. This is foreigners coming in and letting loose and having fun without a lot of benefit to the locals, and in many respects, the opposite of a benefit, really hurting them.
So Cambodia as an example in your book of kind of failed policy because things get overrun and exploited. Mm-hmm. You've got France at the other end as a country that you say has done it very well for a long time. We'll look at that, but France is quite first world now, despite its problems. What about developing countries who are doing it well or less well beyond Cambodia?
Costa Rica, which is one I highlight as doing well of developing countries. Costa Rica, you would say, sort of started out with not a lot. It didn't have any mineral wealth. It didn't have a lot of agriculture. But it had a lot of wildlife. And wisely, instead of cutting it down, all of their forests and their great wildlife on along the beaches, they said, how can we make this work for us? And they were one of the original pioneers of ecotourism. So now it's one of their biggest, if not their biggest sector, along with great things like IT industry. And they're one of the pioneers of medical tourism, which has become huge for Americans.
So they've managed on their small scale to do it well. They've done it partly by not developing so much. Ray in Ennisburg, Vermont. Ray, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to quickly tell you about a quick trip I did with two teenage boys. One of them's my son. Graduate. They were just accepted into universities, and I decided to take them skiing for the first time in Europe.
Wow.
And we had a fabulous time.
Sounds great. Where'd you go?
Well, we flew into Zurich, and then we jumped on trains in Zurich. I set this all up myself, and we went to St. Anton. So you take the three-hour train ride, and then you step off the train, walk up the hill, and you're in a beautiful family guest house for a week. Then we had great skiing, and they, you know, they're strong skiers, but they really got to see Europe, well, at least that part of Europe, firsthand. You know, the public infrastructure that works, the whole train system through Europe is amazing. You can get into any northern European, any European city and jump on a train, and in 3 or 4 hours you can be anywhere in Europe.
Do you have to be rich to take the trip you took, Ray?
I don't think so. The euro is a bit pricey, but, you know, the way it really gave the kids a different perspective on Europe, on different currencies, on different cultures. You know, we would have breakfast in this little inn in the morning, and one table would have some Dutch young girls. Yeah. Another table had a German family. Another table might be some Brits who were skiing over there. And, you know, if you stay in one of these small guest houses, the only arrangements I made in advance was actually booking this room through the St. Anton tourist website. It's not that expensive. Well, I guess it is relatively speaking, but, you know, I thought it was time to take the kids to ski in a different culture.
Yeah, an investment in an eye-opening week or two for some young Americans there, and I'm sure it was eye-opening. Ray, I appreciate your call. I mean, Elizabeth, there's the argument for get out, have fun, get enlightened, see another way of living that has to have value. Do we have to look at it and say, oh, but we're trampling the planet?
No, on contrary. He hit all of the magic points that I put out in the book of the way tourism works well. The trains. It's no accident that that there is such an amazing tourism train system in Europe, and that's because they understand trains are the best way to move tourists. Switzerland subsidizes so much of what he enjoyed, and again, to keep a good quality of tourists that is not going to have to spend a lot of money. Then do you have to be rich? Again, he found a guest house because the governments, and this is in Switzerland and many other European countries, make sure you have a choice. You do not have to be rich. You can be, like the rest of us, a middle-class traveler, and you can find what you can afford. These are governments that make sure all of these elements are available when someone like I can't remember his name. Just
Ray.
Ray can... can make that kind of trip, and that's exactly what the best of tourism is. So thank you for that call.
So keep us on land for a minute, but what's the opposite then? What's the profile of tourism that you find most, I don't know, exploitive or destructing? Stay on land for a minute.
Well, just to do the opposite, the countries that will destroy their forests for a new resort or hotel, that's what you don't want to have happen. And the big country of China, which is so modern now, I was amazed at how much has been cut down for ersatz resort areas. And it took the threat of the loss of the panda, the national animal, to start a real good conservation tourism movement. In Sichuan province now, you have some great wildlife preserves, in large part stimulated by hoping to help keep the panda alive. Tourism can do that, but again, countries sometimes in Africa, for instance, that will cut down the habitat of the wild animals, which is the big tourism brought. That may seem good in the short run, but in the long run, you do lose the environment.
Now, I'm listening and feeling skeptical. Is there really such a footprint of resort hotels that they can take out whole swaths of wildlife on a volume that are that destructive? I mean, it's one thing if you're talking about cutting down the Amazon, you know, for temporary agriculture, but is a resort hotel or even a bunch of them taking up enough acreage that it makes that significant a difference in a country's ecosystem?
Well, it does. It starts to set the tone. There are countries in the Caribbean now that have set aside what they call sacrifice zones on their beaches, where they will allow tourists, particularly from cruise ships, to come. because they will come in big bunches of thousands, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 per ship, 7 ships at the same time.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And they will be restricted to, you know, not like by police, but by tradition, mm-hmm. to one area of the island to protect the rest. So that I'm not saying that the Amazon is going to go down the tubes because of tourism. I'm saying that in answer to the environmental cost, that a lot of it has been thoughtless. And I think you can look along the Spanish coast to get a good example where they had a huge amount of resorts going up very quickly. It was called Costa de Cement after a while, because there were so many hotels that were cement. And they were losing business because it was so bad and because the environment had been degraded. And just a few years ago, a woman became mayor in an election where she promised to get rid of those hotels. And one of the first things she did was explode a hotel and destroy it because it had been so bad.
What about the new populations coming into the travel business? Again, you mentioned the tourism business inside China. Huge, exploding thing just in the last couple of decades. But what about Chinese headed abroad? Where are they headed, and what's the new footprint there?
They're going everywhere. However, Europe remains one of their favorite destinations, and France in particular. The French have done an extraordinary job of promoting this. This is not an accident. In 2009, more Chinese visited Paris than visited all of the United States. The French and the rest of Europe have done quite a few studies about what Chinese tourists want. They have their national websites with in Chinese translation. They have Chinese chefs available for all these new restaurants. They have Chinese translators at the big shops where Chinese go shopping. They have Chinese translators at museums. It is down to that kind of detail. And that's because, as I said, I think by 2020, the Chinese will be the largest number of tourists in the world.
And presumably lots of them going in their own backyards as well in Asia, Southeast Asia, the rest, in Cambodia.
Yes. Well, the funny thing about Chinese and Chinese tourists is that this has had a big effect on the United States in a way that I hadn't realized. Because of the opening of Macau for gambling, Chinese are now taking over much of the gambling from Las Vegas, which is forcing Las Vegas to reimagine how it is as a tourist destination.
Huge global waves of travelers going all over the place from many sources of origin to many destinations. Elizabeth Becker writes about it in her new book, Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. Music here from a video promoting travel to China on the Chinese website tourismchina.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the giant business of global travel and how global tourism is literally changing the world. Elizabeth Becker writes about it in her new book, Overbooked. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Of course, it's all over. Here's the Travel Channel going to the largest mall in the world in Dubai, where a reporter visits an aquarium and scuba dives in a shark tank. Here you hear the discussion in the tank between the reporter and his guide in Dubai.
You would think that it's silent down here, but actually there are a lot of sounds. There's no other words to describe this other than amazing. We have to be very careful when we select the different types of fish for this aquarium. We make sure that we use species which can live together. It's up to the diver to make sure that all animals are fed.
Little squawk box from Dubai. And then, of course, all kinds of issues on cruise lines lately. Carnival's had all kinds of trouble. We've heard it. Here's ABC News reporting on the Carnival Legend, which had to bring 2,000 passengers back to shore after an engine malfunction.
This morning, the Carnival Legend is back at sea, less than 9 hours after unloading more than 2,000 angry travelers Sunday.
A terrible trip, canceled early, 3 days at sea, missed 2 stops, and they only gave us $100.
Last cruise I'm taking, for sure.
The Legend's quick return to the ocean comes in the midst of a series of other PR setbacks for the cruise line in less than 10 days.
Carnival's cruise troubles there. Elizabeth, we've heard a lot about them. You are really tough on the cruise industry generally. You call it out as a major malefactor in global travel. Why?
Well, it's sort of the fast food industry version of tourism. It's cruising used to be a pleasant, quiet way to go from one spot to another. Now you take a cruise and you're lucky to spend, you know, a few hours in one foreign port and then another few hours. The pollution in the ocean is extraordinary. New rules have been had to be put in place for the air pollution. I think I said one ship idling on a dock equals, the air pollution of 12,000 cars.
Wow.
Recently, you know, the Vancouver Winter Olympics, a lot of cruise ships wanted to dock and act like hotels, which is normal. But the city said, if you do that, plug into our electricity system because we don't want that engine idling and have cruise ship haze threatening our Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
Dubai, were you just talking about it?
Yes.
It has the biggest energy footprint of the whole UAE of any in the world, and tourism is a big part of it. They have ice rinks, they have snow skiing jumps
inside there in the desert,
inside the mall. Everything that would drive an environmentalist crazy, they do it. Dubai is using their oil wealth to turn themselves into a very big tourist hub. It's one of the biggest air hubs in the world now. In just two decades, they went from being where is Dubai to the center of a lot of the air traffic in the whole region.
You describe it as a kind of pointless travel. We get in the jetliners, we burn a lot of oil to get there, a lot of fuel, then we burn a lot of oil to stay cool while we're there. But you'd write it off as a kind of a giant shopping mall far away.
I call it consumer tourism, yes. It's shopping. It's a lot of shopping, and it's a lot of hotels that look like an awful lot of other hotels. And in the region, it offers a sort of a liberal consumer alternative to some very restrictive other cultures in the Middle East. But my cruise ship chapter is called Destination Nowhere because you really do not have a clue where you are when you're coming and going. And you go from one swerve to another, and most of the time is sent on a cruise ship that's the size of a huge skyscraper. To go back to Arthur Frommer, he said if he'd known what was going on, he would have never supported the cruise industry.
You talk about labor issues in some of these destinations and on the seas. What do those look like?
I quote extensive studies, Human Rights Watch in particular, for the Middle East, and it's this side of bonded labor, where all those glittering skyscrapers of Dubai are built with South Asian labor in labor camps who make a couple hundred dollars a month. And the cruise ships, it's very easy to find what they pay. They pay $50 a month to most of the servers and waiters and people like that, relying on tips. Now, these are American ships, and so I said, how is this possible? And I talked to the CEO of Royal Caribbean, and they don't follow American rules. They are American companies, but their ships are flagged and registered in foreign countries with relatively no labor or environmental rules, and that's the way you get around it. So if you human rights are an issue for a lot of travelers.
Pay attention. Let's get Nick on from Boonville, New York. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well.
I'm 70 years old, and back in 1990, okay, when I was 50, I remortgaged my house, and my kids were in between the ages of 9 and 16, so I figured for the next 3 years I was going to take them places. So I took them the first summer, because I'm a teacher. I went, and we went to Hawaii, but we did this all on backpacking, and we did it all with because I toured Europe when I was younger, okay?
Yeah.
I did the whole deal in Europe a couple of times.
Sure.
So we backpacked and we took little trailer trucks around, and we did New Zealand, Australia. And then the following year, we did the Amazon, Costa Rica, and went through that area. My wife speaks Spanish, so that's a plus. And then we did Alaska, okay? And then the following year, we did Iceland and Europe, all right? So my kids now are between 40 and 31, all right? And to this day, they say, Dad, I'm glad we did it. And we're all divers, right?
Yeah.
And we got to see the barrier reef before it was half gone. And we've dove a lot of places. And sadly, okay, and I agree with your author there, there's a real issue, okay, between plastics in the ocean. And we're destroying everything. And we don't have to. We really don't have to do this.
So, Nick, we can hear how precious that experience was to you and your family, how glorious it was. And now Elizabeth is telling us, well, you know what? A billion people a year are doing their version of that. Not at all backpacking like you, but I don't know, Nick, can you imagine a point at which the exquisite pleasure and value and insight of all that travel you did with your family is somehow offset by the sheer volume of humans trying to get around the world?
What it is that here's the best way to look at it. This is my belief.
Yeah.
Go to Nassau in the Bahamas. I've been going to the Bahamas for 50 years diving there, all right? You go to Nassau in the Bahamas now. If you look at it, it's a hotel after hotel. Nassau, there used to be conch all around. It's gone.
Sure.
Everything is gone. So what's happening is that for the quest of profit instead and amusement, this is amusement. This is not nature.
So, but what about a teacher? What about a teacher and their family? He's 50 or she's 50 years old now, Nick? Would you still encourage them to do what you did, or should they stay home and do ecotourism in their backyard to avoid the, I don't know, fossil fuel footprint?
What I would do is this, okay? I would get a group of people, okay, together, and I would focus on a particular area to go, whereas ecotourism, as your author suggested, Costa Rica. When they were in ecotourism back in 1990.
So go where it's good. I love your call, Nick. I mean, Elizabeth, here's the story. So are you saying let's, you know, get out there and do what Nick did with his family? And I'm sure they have the most glorious memories from that. Or there are just too many of us trying to do that now. Rein it in, folks.
Well, there's another way to look at it. And besides, as travelers, we're also citizens. And I think if we looked at tourism as the big industry it is, and this is, and showed it the respect we would the oil industry, we would have the tourism industry at the table when we discussed environmental issues, at the table when the government discussed climate control issues. And if the industry was treated that way, I think it would then understand and be scrutinized for its effect in all of these ways. Right now, it's off to the side. We think of it, travel and tourism, as pastime, and it's just simply our tourist responsibility to find answers. Well, if the industry was part, I mean, in other countries where it works, there are ministries of tourism. The United States doesn't. The United States is allergic to talking about tourism as an important issue. And that's my whole last chapter is talking about this, that if we in the United States said, okay, tourism is really serious and it has serious consequences, let's have it treated that way, that it there are government issues here, so on and so forth. And I think then it would be easier to wrap our arms around this and realize that it's not entirely on all our shoulders. It's the government and the industry, too.
Of course, who knows where it's going to go. As you know, maybe if the Chinese are the biggest travelers in the world in 1 year soon, their decisions may be the most consequential. John in New Orleans. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just wanted to talk about my experience with cultural tourism in Tanzania. And I had an amazing opportunity to go to Tanzania in 2006. And you would never think about necessarily traveling or making a huge vacation out of Tanzania, much less all these little towns in countries and cities and throughout East Africa that you would have never heard of. And I just found that there was a spattering of little places in each town that are just beginning to develop called cultural tourism offices. And you walk in and you sign your name and you give them like $3, and the next thing you know, a teenager is taking you up deep into the Uluguru Mountains of East Africa and allowing you to meet witch doctors and shamans and the cultures of the Uluguru people. Or when I went down to Kilwa in way down south in Tanzania, the next thing I know, I give a guy $5 and he takes me on a little boat to a little isolated island called Kisiwani, which has all these amazing ruins from like the 12th century. And I just think it's fascinating how many places exist that we would have never even heard of and that never come up on any travel guide.
John, I know exactly the joy you're talking about in seeing that kind of way off the road places. Who wouldn't love it, and who wouldn't love it even now? But Elizabeth, I wonder, when you listen to that, are you thinking, bravo, John, or are you thinking, well, you know, those are the first tendrils of the superhighway of tourists to follow that will just walk over it?
No, it's the first. Bravo, John. And if the locals keep control of their tourism, it will only help both the tourists and the locals. This is he's just described the best kind of tourism, and that's what I hope will prosper. And he also describes how just about anything can be turned into tourism. I talked about medical tourism. There's sports tourism. How many bicycle trips have all the listeners have taken around the world? Mm-hmm. Those also help. There's something called genocide tourism. People who are interested in human rights will go around the world to the Holocaust sites, to Rwanda. There's political tourism, we sometimes call conventions or conferences. We are turning everything into a travel opportunity. And then if we're like John and go and see the locals and pay them to guide us through their local community, that's exactly what works. And that's what keeps us buying those airplane tickets.
A couple of folks online here, Tatiana says on Twitter, you know, she says, I'm a resident of a beach town in Brazil. She says, I'd have to say I'd rather not see so many of them tourists at once. Summers, Brazilian summers are tough. It can blow up in a hurry. Here's kind of the big response from William. He says he wonders if international tourism is creating a virtual Pangea or Pangea. I'm not sure, but are we becoming over-connected? Sort of a continuation of this phenomenon, he says, creating a lack of biodiversity, eventual collapse of all the firewalls that nature created through natural geographic separation, invasive species, gene pools moving to oneness. I mean, I don't know where the global population is headed, 9 billion, 10 billion maybe. You hear the concern there, Elizabeth, that we become overconnected. We're all flowing into one another. It sounds great in some way, but like a nightmare in another.
Yes, and I also hear in that, both in Tatiana's and in the last comment, a real wondering if we're all being too superficial in all of this. I mean, we're traveling, if we're taking over her Brazilian coastal town, mm-hmm. we're too much of us. We come in and out. We don't speak Portuguese. We don't get to know any of the locals, and we're in and out. And that's also part of one of the problems with the global pandemics. It's always the tourists who are bringing the illnesses around. And if we didn't take so many trips and we really spent some time planning them and maybe getting a little more into the locals like John was in Africa, I think that will answer some of those issues and go a long way.
More mindful travel, more mindful tourism. But we look at the big travel spreads and come-ons and ads, and it's all, you know, the lowest cost for the most days, and we'll get you there. Kevin in Brighton, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay, what do you think?
Well, basically, I just want to harp on, I guess, maybe a few minutes ago, you guys were talking about, you know, the world peace and, you know, the fact that there's, you have people from, you know, just interacting, that first, how to say it, there's like a mutual benefit of people from different cultures meeting for the first time. And I don't think that should be overlooked.
Amen.
I just turned 30, and a lot of my early trips to Europe and briefly to India as well, I wouldn't say I made a footprint. I think there's all kinds of different tourism. Obviously, we're talking more so about people in resort hotels. Those can be the worst
yep.
Offenders and whatnot. But I don't think it should be overlooked that the actual mutual benefit of both cultures, like the Chinese tourists in L.A., it's like the fact that they can see us for who we are, and then when we go over there, you can see them for who they are.
Kevin, our time is so short, but I couldn't agree more with that. I'm just sort of trying to balance some of Elizabeth's messages right alongside that. I mean, how about it, Elizabeth? You know, Kevin goes right to the heart
totally
of it. Know one another. Get out there and meet.
Absolutely. And that's why I very much wrote this book, because I agree with you 100%. The best diplomat is the tourist. No question. And if we protect tourism, we'll keep being good diplomats, visiting each other's countries. You're right on the money.
But do it with a sense of what, how, and with what footprint you do leave behind in addition to that meeting of hearts or minds. You open our eyes, Elizabeth, to just the scale of what's going on and the need to be thoughtful about it, even as we need to get to know one another and see and do. Really appreciate it. The new book is Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. Elizabeth Becker joined us from Washington, D.C. today. Elizabeth, thanks so much for your work and for your thoughts today.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I enjoyed it very much.
On Monday, we'll talk about a pretty big traveler. Homer's Iliad, a one-man performance, takes the ancient tale and brings it home for modern men and women. Homer, the Iliad, on Monday. Join us then. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.